So collectively today, Africa spends about $55 billion on security. The biggest misconception is we have to build much more precise firepower. What Africa lacks today is intelligence, sovereign intelligence.
Can you break down for our audience what you mean by sovereign intelligence?
Sovereign intelligence essentially means the capacity to collect surveillance data, analyze this data, and predict outcomes or insights on a particular attack across your infrastructure, your people, or your resources. Today, Africa relies a lot on foreign intelligence. The drones that is capturing data for us is not ours. The satellites is not ours. And that becomes a huge problem because
Nathan Wachuku was 15 years old when he lost sight in one eye. At 17, he turned down a full university scholarship. At 19, he had already built one company used by hundreds of thousands. And by 22, he was running Terra Industries, a defense and autonomous systems company protecting billions of dollars worth of African infrastructure across 8 countries.
My question was, what is the one foundational pinpoint that once you can solve it, it would literally spark a revolution in every single industry? It's not energy, it's not food production, it's not education, it's not health, it's not any of these other industries. What they all depend on is...
Nathan, you raised $11.75 million.
So my question is, when you are talking to clients, do they ever say, what does a 22-year-old know about defense?
We see the tweets, and every single day what we see is, we love Afropolitan. This podcast is underrated. This is the best podcast ever. But the problem is 82% of you are not subscribers, but I know you guys are watching. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Thank you.
Nathan, so someone's going to click your specific video and they are going to maybe be on the way to work. Maybe they're winding down from a long day. Maybe they just want to hear what you have to say. So the first question I have to you that I want you to tell our Afropolitan audience is, what is a common misconception about the defense industry in Africa?
I think first off is that the only way to tackle insecurity is by adding more firepower.
Interesting.
You know, the biggest misconception is, we have to build more firepower, much more precise firepower. What Africa lacks today is intelligence, sovereign intelligence. You know, being able to understand previous attacks, being able to part out pattern recognition that can help you predict future attacks. And this is what has been lacking on the continent, essentially for the last few decades. And this is what we are trying to do.
So I'm going to ask something controversial, because it's been the ongoing conversation as we record this podcast. So the other day, you know, they were talking about firepower, right? And they showed a map. And my concern was, when they showed Africa, it was like, we have none. Like, it's like empty. Is that real? Is that not? Like, even though you're saying, you know, we don't actually need as much firepower as we need, you don't still think that is necessary?
So it's when you compare the firepower that, of course, Russia, yeah, the US,
yes,
the major world powers have, you know, they have enough for the kind of wars they are fighting. The kind of wars we are fighting is not necessarily state-on-state wars. It's mostly with terrorist groups. You don't need to have ballistic missile systems. You know, you don't need to have submarines. You don't need to have a lot of the advanced weaponry that the West builds out. For what we have today, I'm talking Nigeria, I'm talking other countries, it's enough for the kind of war on terror that is currently raging. So it's relative, essentially.
Okay. And can you break down for our audience, because they may not really understand that. So when you're saying state on state, what does that actually mean?
Yes.
So they can understand.
So state on state means you're not seeing Nigeria fighting, you know,
Burkina Faso
or Ghana. You're not seeing, you know, countries fighting countries. A lot of the wars in Africa are always internal conflicts, you know, mostly fighting terrorist groups, non-state actors, that don't have their own level of sophisticated weaponry. You can't compare that to a state actor, you know, if you're fighting a nation. So that's what we mean by state actors and non-state actors.
Also, from a sovereign intelligence perspective, because I love that you speak about that, you said Africa doesn't necessarily prioritize that. Can you break down for our audience what you mean by sovereign intelligence?
Yeah. Sovereign intelligence essentially means, you know, the capacity to collect, you know, surveillance data, ISRO data, analyze this data and predict outcomes or insights, you know, on a particular attack, across your infrastructure, your people or your resources. Today, Africa relies a lot on foreign intelligence. You know, the drones that is capturing data for us is not ours. The satellites is not ours. The software, even the human intelligence for a lot of countries, they depend on foreign Western, you know, agencies to actually articulate what is going on in their own country. And that becomes a huge problem, you know, because first of all, you never truly fully get the right contextualized data from these guys. They don't understand your country better than you. You know, there's always room for misinterpretation. And this is where you now see countries, you know, misfire or, you know, target the wrong group of people. Second is you look at data sovereignty. You know, national security data should not be held anywhere else but by you. And that brings a lot of problems too. You know, if you're hosting your national security data in other continents, in other countries, that is not yours, because it allows room for sabotage or even blackmail. So there's a lot of issues with sovereign intelligence. Every continent, every major world power strives for that, except Africa. You know, it's almost like we're completely happy offshoring our national security, you know, while acting like it's all okay. So this is essentially what we mean by sovereign intelligence.
I love that you broke that down. Now, from a hardware software perspective, we're having this conversation offline. I think there are going to be people who are tuning into this podcast and they're like, we're super intelligent. We usually understand software. We understand software as a service. We understand technology. But for some reason, Africans don't tend to necessarily play or believe that they can play in the hardware space, right? This is core hard. Like, this is not like you're not playing. It's like a drone is taking off. Things are happening that are harder. Where could you break down to our audience why you believe that Africans should be playing also more in hardware? Not to say that we ignore software, but hardware is important. Like, why should we do hard things in that way?
Yeah. If you look at where Africa is today as a continent, you know, it's undergoing an era of rapid industrialization, you know, finally. But there's still a lot of foundational infrastructure that lacks on the continent, you know, across security, energy, several other very foundational problems that we haven't fully solved. You can't solve that by your fintech apps. You know, you can't solve that by just relying on software only. Software thrives on hardware. You know, the best softwares on the world is because they are backed up by great hardware. And, you know, I would say the culture right now in the ecosystem, where a lot of people are scared of hardware, is more psychological. You know, there's an unspoken, you know, rule almost, where a lot of people feel Africans are not smart enough to build anything more than websites or apps. Mm. It's very unspoken, but
it's a belief
that is not just with non-Africans. Even the Africans themselves believe this. You know, they believe once it's beyond websites or apps, oh, that is too advanced for us. And we wanted to show that that's not right. You know, it's intelligence is distributed equally around the world. It's all about just meeting the right opportunity. So it's for us, the next stage of Africa's growth right now, you know, which is basically how can it fully industrialize and capture its full potential, would require us to build sovereign hardware infrastructure. You know, not just in security, we need to build energy infrastructure. We need to build for food production, for in health. These are things that you can't just do with software alone. So this is why I believe that we're kind of entering like a phase two of the ecosystem where more people would actually do hard things.
You know, I read Elon Musk's book and he was speaking to his background in terms of physics and the role physics plays in understanding hardware, right? So from a, I guess, a foundational layer of like frameworking, right? Yeah. Can you break down, because I know you also had a physics background, right? Can you break down why physics is important for our building as a nation or as a continent? And also, I think this is more of a question for you to also appeal to talent that's watching, right? So you're talking about talent that can be based, whether it's in the diaspora or based on the ground, as to why should they focus on pivoting into hardware spaces and attracting that sort of talent to come build in this space as well. But can you, from a foundational layer, explain why physics is also important for us to have a foundational understanding of hardware as well?
Yeah. I think for me personally, physics changed my life. You know, was very active in the physics Olympiads. I actually wanted to be a professor of physics. You know, then I realized they didn't have money.
That's the evil you.
You know, so I quickly pivoted. But I think for this new hardware renaissance that Africa is about to have, physics is very fundamental because it allows you to see problems from the first principles. You know, when you want to solve a problem, and this is basically how you solve like a typical physics equation, you know, you have to basically strip it down to its very first core principles and then go back up again. You know, it allows you see problems from a very different perspective than how other people may view problems. And this was actually how I realized that security was what needed to be solved in Africa. Because, you know, my question was, what could you solve in Africa that cuts across everything? You know, what is the one foundational pinpoint that once you can solve it, it would literally spark a revolution in every single industry. It's not energy, because energy still requires security. It's not food production. Most of our farmers in the north are not even farming right now. It's not, you know, it's not education. Most kids, again,
are being kidnapped.
You know, we see this news almost every few weeks. It's not health. It's not any of these other industries. What they all depend on is security. And that is like, if you want to solve Africa's industrial problem today, the first thing you have to do is first lay that modern security infrastructure, then everything else comes on top. And even our software ecosystem would require security. You know, Africa today made a very big mistake by completely jumping the industrial, you know, revolution. We first began as an agrarian economy, then we completely jumped, you know, that whole industrial process and became a service economy, which means that period where a lot of civilizations during that period have low income, large youth population. And that is when they throw them into the factories to do, you know,
vocational
low tech production. Mm-hmm. And at that point, over a few years, they eventually become middle class and all that. That's typically how middle class is formed, you know, during that industrial era. Because we didn't go through that phase, we essentially have a large, pretty broke youth population that have no jobs. A service economy can never provide enough jobs. And now foreign investors are not going to invest in industry in Africa because of security. The local industrialists don't trust Africa. You know, like they would rather go and invest their money in Dubai. You know, Dangote was saying it a few weeks back that rather than investing here, they would rather invest their money in Dubai or some other countries because again, they don't trust the African environment. So basically putting a modern security infrastructure is foundational to everything, to sparking the industrial growth here. And that was something I wouldn't have figured out without using the first principle, framework that physics taught me. Mm.
You know, it's funny because I was just writing something on LinkedIn the other day about this first principles thing. Yeah. And I think for us, even with what we do here with Afropolitan, it started from a first principles perspective, which was, yeah. I think I'm a big fan of Naval. We talk about it on the podcast. And, you know, after reading his book, I think for me, there was a quote in there that he has, which is, society will reward you for giving it what it wants, but does not yet know how to get, right? Yeah. And that to me is like the basis of what entrepreneurship and even building is at scale. And I think for me, when I was sitting down and when I was sharing it with Chika, I was like, what is the one layer of thing that society really wants? Like our people, our Africans everywhere wants deeply, but they've not yet been able to get. And can we solve for that? And for me, my own revelation was it was good governance, right? But I'm now realizing, even we're talking to you, like, you're broken it down even to a sub-layer atom, right? Yeah, good governance might be the catch-all phrase, but under good governance, one of the things in good governance is security, right? Like, if you don't have security, if you're not able to secure things, if you're not able to guarantee things that are, that people are going to be safe underneath it, where do you go from there? But I wanted us to pivot to the fundraising journey, right? I think I wrote an article about Terra, like, when you guys first raised, and I wanted you to, from your perspective, share what the journey was like for you, especially, like, you're walking into a room, you're talking to investors who may or may not be educated in this space, especially sometimes people from where we're from, right? And what did that look like for you guys to articulate your vision, help break it down to people? And I'm sure some people still don't get it, but what did that journey look like for you, especially for founders who are looking to go raise in hardware moving forward? What was your journey like?
Yeah, I mean, it was as tough as every other founder's journey. But I think even tougher because, as you said, you know, a lot of investors, especially African investors, they didn't understand. It's a very new market. It's a blue ocean market. We don't look like the typical defense founders, you know. And also, you know, there were just a lot of questions around how can this even scale in Africa? You know, like, how can this be built? How would this be fun? Like, there were so many questions. And it was very tough trying to educate them because, you know, they are used to the fintech ecosystem. They are used to, you know, funding those type of startups. Their entire expertise have been built around that. It's very hard to break someone from that framework. But I think that is slowly changing. You know, they are starting to be a bit more open-minded. But eventually, we had to actually just go to the circles that understand. You know, and that was what eventually led us to Silicon Valley. You know, our very first pre-seed, we had an investor that was actually my age. You know, his name is Coco, Silicon Valley investor that put the first institutional, you know,
check
backing for that round. You know, and his entire belief was more philosophical and more geopolitical. You know, he understood that where the world is going today, every continent would need a sovereign defense capability. You know, the world powers today are retracting. You know, the days of global hegemony is ending.
Yeah.
And we're entering an age of regional hegemonies where the US now in the Donwood Doctrine is focusing on the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
You know, China is going to focus on theirs. Europe is looking inwards. Every single continent is now looking inwards to building their own defense capabilities, except Africa, which is still looking for handouts from around the world. So it was clear that Africa would need a regional defense prime that would, you know, be stationed to protect it. And he understood where that was going, you know, both from a philosophical point of view and geopolitical point of view. And I think that is something a lot of, you know, the African VCs I spoke to initially, they lacked. You know, a lot of them don't invest based on ideology or philosophies, mostly just based on, you know, the markets and the market they understand.
Did you agree with, I don't know if you even had a chance to read it, so I don't want to assume, but
yeah,
I wrote something about like the philosophical worldview that they like. Would you say that's been your experience raising? Because that was also our experience raising, where I'm like, yo, no offense, and I know people are going to be watching, but I'm like, what books do you guys read? Like, do you watch movies? Do you watch documentaries? Like, what informs your worldview? Because it's almost like you're talking to someone, I'm like, I don't expect you to know everything, but you don't have a foundational layer of what your, like, your capital should have a worldview.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? You can't be a capital allocator. It's like, what is the point of having the money to invest? And sometimes it's not your money because it's LP's money, but when you're convincing LPs, it should also be like, what's your worldview? What is the world you want to see when this reaches actualization? And so for some of them, it's like, no, I just came into this to just double the money. That's it. And I'm just like, bro, like, okay.
Yeah, and I actually want to add, because I actually think if we're talking about some of the things you're saying, that, you know, we skipped a lot of steps. So now we need to step back and build some of these industries. We can't keep building on just fintech, Like, I think we've built all the fintech we can build. I don't know what else we're solving at this point, but I agree that, you know, when we're, I really want investors to hear this part, because I feel like a lot of African investors, we're going to keep relying on handouts if we don't get to the point where we're investing in worldviews. We're investing in, like, how do you see Africa moving forward? And Africa does not reliant on other countries or other types of entities in order to prop us up as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I think even further, what was the exact amount you raised? I want to talk 11. About 5 that.
11.5 million.
Okay.
Seed, yeah. That's
11.75 yeah, million dollars. Yeah. Okay, because that, we got to say that number, because people think it's impossible. So I'm curious, were there a lot of institutional investors, or were there a lot of angels to get to that point?
It was mostly institutional. Mm-hmm. You know, it was led by 8VC, owned by Palantir founder, Joe Lonsdale. And in participation was Value Equity, Silicon Valley Angels, Lux Capital, you know, the usual guys in okay. Silicon. We only had about, I think, two angels.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was really purely an institutional round.
Wow. Only two angels?
Yeah.
Wow. And so were any of these Africans? No. okay. We got to say that. We got to say it out loud. That's a problem.
Well, not in this round, but in the first round.
Okay.
We do have a few African investors that got in the first round.
Okay.
Yeah. But for this round, no, we're not able to get in African investors before the round closed up. And for us, really, we were also looking for people that have built global defense primes before. Mm. You know, these are the same exact set of companies that built Palantir, that built Anduril. They know what it takes to build a multi-billion dollar defense prime. You know, we wanted to work with people that fully understand the stakes and the sacrifice it would take to build something like this, mm-hmm. you know, and that was why we went with them.
Etche, remember that time I walked into a bank, I'm not going to give the name, and I asked them for $1,000 and they told me no, they cannot withdraw any dollar for me. And I was so upset. And I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have V-Band to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have VBAN as a sponsor for that Fulton podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast.
So something interesting is you're 22, right? I want to confirm your age. Okay. So you're 22, right? I'm 37, right? So I've seen... I've seen the world. I've seen a lot of things. So my question is, when you are talking to clients, right, do they ever say, what does a 22-year-old know about defense?
Not really. Probably if I was doing this 5 years ago, they would have cared. But right now, things are getting so bad. The world is getting mad.
Yeah.
You know, and people are getting to a level of desperation that's... Africa needs a madman, you know. No matter how that madman looks, they are ready to work with him. So it was just perfect timing for that.
Yeah. And it's so funny you use the word hedge money, because funny enough, I don't know if you saw the Canadian Prime Minister, right? You saw the word he used. He kept using that word specifically, right? So I'm even more curious after Davos, have you seen like some emails come through? Like, well, maybe we need to, you know, reflect on the type of, you know, services you're offering. I'm curious, have you seen an uptick or just more people being interested just based off of those conversations that happened?
I think in terms of geopolitics, you know, it's the US will always be a strong partner to key countries around the world. I mean, the US is a good partner to Nigeria, to most of Africa, and they will keep on being a good partner. But at the same time, we are starting to see a shift in their foreign policy where they are now also focusing inwards. You know, they want to rebuild back their industrial base. You know, they want to ensure that the Western Hemisphere is protected from foreign adversaries. Right now, that is their primary objective. Everything else is secondary, possibly even tertiary. And for us, you know, we are focused on building a sovereign capability for the continent to protect itself. But of course, it doesn't mean that we want to turn Africa into a Sharia. You know, like, there's still going to be a world where we will still need global partners. But now is more from a framework where we are working as partners, not begging for handouts. You know, we already have our own capability and we are now working with our global allies to even elevate what we already have. It's, you see this being done with Europe. You see this being done with Japan. These are countries that have the industrial base to produce whatever they want, but they still work with, you know, global, global allies like America. So I think that is where Africa is going to evolve with, if Terra wins.
Yeah. And I'm even more curious, what is your typical client? Because I'm thinking about consistently when America, especially during elections, they always talk about the defense budget, right? And as soon as you were talking, I was like, what defense budget do we have? Like, that's what I'm thinking. Like, is it important? Is it private entities? Like, I'm curious, you know, what budgets are being set in place for the type of, you know, business you're building?
So collectively today, Africa spends about $55 billion on security.
Okay.
You know, cutting across protecting its infrastructure, its resources, and its people. There's a saying that African governments don't pay. But actually, I like to edit that saying a bit. African governments pay for security and energy. You know, those are the two, because even African governments understand that those are the two pillars that are foundational to every civilization. You don't play with security, you don't play with energy. So even in that, like, we don't have any issue with that. And that budget is basically based on just the typical government defense budgets collectively. You know, we're not talking on what the private sector guys are spending on protecting their own privately owned assets. You know, what because for Terra, we focus on both the government pipelines and also the commercial pipeline. Like, we are working with privately owned infrastructure assets, power plants that are owned by billionaires and commercial companies, refineries, you know,
yeah,
mines,
a lot of oil and gas, I would assume,
and all that.
Yeah.
So those guys are collectively spending another few tens of billions, you know. So the market is much larger than people actually realize, and it keeps growing. You know, it's the defense market in Africa is the fastest growing market right now. Mostly because the threat is evolving faster than any other continent. You know, these terrorists now are getting smarter. They are now using drones. We saw the news early last year. They're using drones now to attack several installations across the Sahel. So, since as instability increases, that market is only going to get much larger, and it would, you know, probably Terra won't even be enough. You know, this market will probably have two or three winners, you know. So this is where we see the industry going.
I like this because I want you to break down for our audience what actually happens to a country, right, when critical infrastructure like pipelines, power plants,
yeah,
are insecure, even if there's no war, right? So
yeah,
again, I think it helps to drive the value that Terra is actually providing,
yeah,
here. Can you break that down for our audience?
So if you look at a civilization today, you know, let's say you're building Sims, you know, like SimCity. If you want that civilization to run, essentially, you have to build some foundational pillars that will enable them to run. You will need power plants for energy. You will need commercial farmlands for food production. You will need, you know, refineries for the oil and all that. You know, there's all this critical infrastructure that will need to be put in place to enable society run smoothly. Now, what happens if those infrastructure assets are attacked and blown up? In a matter of hours, that society is completely turned upside down. People don't understand what it means to live without those assets. Like, just try to think about what it will mean if all the power plants, all the refineries, our farmlands, our borders, the telecommunication towers, all of these assets are destroyed all at once right now. Suddenly, your communication is completely cut off from the world. Power is gone. In a few days, there will be food scarcity. People would starve to death. You know, the borders will be porous, will be flooded with unwanted people we don't want. It will turn into basically an apocalypse. So critical infrastructure is very important to enabling, you know, smooth sailing for a civilization to run. And my own thesis is that it's even more important than the actual shooting war. You know, like, this is why Terra itself have entirely focused on protecting critical infrastructure, because this is a market that never dies. You always have to protect it, you know, and you can protect it without going kinetic. You're always playing on the defensive and predictive side of defense, because we personally, we never want to go kinetic. We're not interested in going kinetic. I don't think the type of war Africa is fighting requires us to go kinetic. As I said earlier, the firepower is more than enough. So basically just enabling, you know, a large scale mesh network of defense systems all connected to each other, all sharing data with each other, and enabling our governments to now, rather than acting from a reactive point of view, they're now being more predictive. You know, they're able to predict future attacks and intercept them before it happens. That is where we want to get Africa to.
For our audience, could you break down what you meant by kinetic?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Okay, kinetic is essentially weapons, like weapons that can kill, weapons that can neutralize. So in defense, there are essentially two categories of systems. Well, there are other much smaller categories, but I'll just focus on the two main. There is ISRO, so intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. That is where Terra plays. And there's kinetics, the people that builds the weapons that then destroy after ISRO is done. Most of the global defense players today play mostly in kinetics. You know, the Anduril, Helsing, only very few play purely in ISRO, like Palantir. And for the kind of war these guys are fighting, you know, you see the war in Russia and Ukraine, it requires them, it's mostly a kinetic warfare. You know, they are going through millions of attritable systems at an industrial scale. They need to essentially produce weapons at a massive, you know, scale. You look at the US too, you know, that is the kind of system that they need. They already have enough ISRO from their satellites and all that. So they essentially need to focus more on attritable kinetics. But when you come to Africa, you know, again, the kind of war we're fighting here, we're fighting, you know, terrorist groups that beyond, you know, a few, beyond a few guns, grenades, maybe they may have a few other slightly more sophisticated systems. It's not sophisticated enough that what we have right now, the fighter jets we have, the missiles we have, is not enough. It's more than enough to take care of these guys. But the problem now is, where are they? You know, how are they perpetrating these attacks? How are they coming? Where, you know, like, using previous attacks, how could you, you know, plot out possible ways that they would attack, possible doctrines, possible strategies, and intercept them? And this is what we're trying to do now. And essentially, that's why Terra plays in that ISRO field.
It's funny because me and Chika just came back from vacation, so we were resting. I was reading a lot of, I said to her that I feel like war is coming at some point. So people who are students of history really need to go and start like reading up on this stuff, because I think our generation has forgotten what world wars used to look like because we're so far removed. The reason why I'm bringing this up is obviously back then they used to have carriers, and you know, the different types of wars they would fight are very different from now. And I think Ukraine and Russia have shown how different that is. And going back to your point, it doesn't make sense to deploy a fighter jet against like 10, 15 bandits and some, like even just the fuel to fill up the jets is more than you would spend to do anything. So it doesn't make any sense. And I think I was reading that that's where countries like Turkey and a bunch of these other guys have stepped up to produce like drones and things that can, that might be smaller cost to produce, but have much more, bigger effects. Where I wanted us to go to is talent, right? We already touched about it a little bit, right? But why should a young engineer today, or a young person today who's looking to go into technology, you know, focus or be proud to build in this space compared to like the software features that they already like, that they already have so many examples of? Like, why should more of our talent focus on this hardware space?
I think, because it matters, you know, very controversial opinion, but my personal belief is the smartest engineers, the smartest minds in Africa should not be wasting their time on SaaS. You know, it's a complete waste of your time. We have much more fundamental, much more important, much more urgent problems to solve. You know, and we need the best brains on those problems. So it's you know, first and foremost, it's just a simple answer. It just matters. Like, it matters now where the world is heading now. We need the best brains. The best possible outcomes too would possibly come from here too. You know, because the people that build the rails, the people that build the infrastructure, once Africa industrializes, will be the biggest winners. The people that build the security infrastructure, the energy infrastructure, communications, all of that, in 10, 15, 20 years, you know, we are the ones that will essentially be the biggest winners of this new age industrial revolution that is ongoing right now. So there is much more upside rather than going to drag a super saturated market, you know, that basically hasn't grown in the last 2 years, you know. And second, is cool as shit. You know, like, what possible stuff could you do that is cooler than this? You know, like, it brings a lot of fulfillment to everyone working at Terra today. You know, I've never seen people that are so happy at Terra today. You know, they come to the factory even when they're not even meant to come. Like, some of them sleep there. You know, like, they talk about what we're doing so much, because at Terra, it's a very mission-driven problem. You know, when you talk about defense, this is not some abstract problem that everyone knows someone that has been affected by insecurity. It's either a family member, a friend of a friend, or sometimes even them directly. At Terra, we have people that have lost, like, families, you know, friends, brothers, from insecurity, even I personally. So this is something that is very close to home, and beyond, you know, the very beautiful compensation and payment package, by the way, beyond that, people feel like this is a mission, like this is a battle for the soul and fate of Africa, you know. And, you know, we have been bestowed upon this to essentially lead the charge. So it's we're currently hiring, by the way. So, reach out and, yeah.
But actually, I have a follow-up question to this. So since you gather a lot of intelligence, literally, I'm curious, because you're saying, you know, you have a great brain, have a future among you, don't waste your time in SaaS. What other industries out of defense are you literally seeing that you feel like some of these brains need to go into, that you think there's a blue ocean?
Energy. Mm-hmm. Energy. Sustainable energy. Our energy infrastructure today is not nearly good enough to power Africa even in 25 years. You know, with the current trajectory of Africa's demographic growth, population growth, the amount of industries that will be needed to sustain the continent, we need a very robust, sustainable energy infrastructure. And I think that there's going to be a second energy wave coming, you know, but it won't be the old guys, you know, and it won't be the typical ways that we are seeing today. So I'm very excited about energy, really. I keep track of that market a lot. I read up a lot on what's going on there. You know, I've made a few angel bets myself, to be honest. So energy, communication, you know, again, because of the current demographic growth, there is, I think in a few years, you know, close to half a billion people that would need to be onboarded, you know, on a new communication infrastructure. So essentially, for me, it's very, very basic, you know, things, even food production. We need more sustainable ways to boost urban food production now, because we can't entirely depend on rural food production, like the way we have been producing food is not fast enough. It's not efficient enough to support the large population of Africa. You know, we need newer, more efficient, much faster ways to do things. So these are some of the industries I think are going to be gold mines very soon. I think we need more builders that are building big projects here.
It's funny because a couple of years ago, I think it might have been pre-COVID or during COVID, I was reading something about how the Chinese government was intentionally stopping, or at least trying to, you know, encourage the best brains to not just be going, because I think they realized and woke up and realized that their best brains were leaving college or leaving high school to go and start working at like TikTok type companies or Facebook type companies. And like, how can the best of you be dedicating your brain space to like gamification of getting people addicted to scrolling? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, we need people in, you know, what do you call it? Even like the EV market or these different markets, like you just talked about, the hardware stuff, right? So I think I remember reading that and being taken aback because I was in a position where I was seeing the best of us who were even Africans graduating from these schools abroad and like, hey, I'm going to go work at Facebook. I'm going to go work at TikTok. And I think at that time, you're proud to say you work at those companies because that's the Nigerian-American dream. You have properly drop out. But then when you sit back at it and you say, but I'm literally one of the best at what I do, to whom much is given, much is required. And you're telling me what was required from you is to allow somebody to scroll on Instagram. That's diabolical, right? And I think that that's why I love this conversation, because I think a lot of those talents who are watching are slowly starting to realize, like, look, you have Japad, you no longer, your beard now connects, your skin is glowing, you've been at Facebook for 5, 6, 7 years, you've vested some stock options, you are now needed to come back home or come, or in some way or fashion, contribute to building things that will actually impact the vast majority of our people. Like, our best minds cannot be stuck working at a TikTok or working at a Facebook. Like, I'm sorry. Like, after 2, 3, 4 years, make your money, but it's time for us to, like Nathan is saying, like, we need to, time is of the essence. We need actually our best minds to pivot. Where I wanted to now go take this conversation to is, we talked about philosophy back then, right? Or a couple of minutes ago. We grew up in a world where globalization was the thing, right? And it, to be fair, if we give a good account, globalization seems to have worked out for countries like China or for the vast majority of countries who are looking to develop, right? What is your philosophy? Because obviously in this current environment, it does benefit Terra, right? When you step back, and I think you might be a student of history a little bit, right? When you analyze globalization and this retrenchment that's happening, are you pro-globalization? Where do you think globalization ended up being like a good thing? And what were some of the downside effects of it? I just want to get your philosophy and worldview on that.
Yeah. So I'm very much for globalization, or at least what it was meant to be, you know. It quickly devolved. And this is why I think the problem with globalization happened. You know, if you study countries in the 19th, 18th, even the 20th century, they were much more independent than they are today. You know, you had even second tier, third tier countries in a lot of different continents having a booming manufacturing sector across different industries. You know, they could provide at least the fundamental necessities for just civilians, irrespective of global trade. But what globalization has become in the 21st century is essentially we are entirely depending on just, you know, very few countries. You know, not more than 3 to 4 is essentially supplying the world of most of its goods. That is very dangerous. Super dangerous, especially now that we're entering a new era, you know, and in the current geopolitical winds, you don't want to be essentially dependent on foreign powers, you know, for your normal day-to-day life. So I think I'm out for what's actually going on right now of everyone basically looking inwards, retracting back to their regional spheres of influence, building up their own industries. But I still support leaving the global markets open. So it's going to be a mix of both, where we are all building our own industries. Of course, not everyone, for example, there will be no one, at least for the next foreseeable future, would beat the semiconductor industry in Taiwan.
Yeah.
You know, the automotive industry in Germany would always remain competitive. I think every country has something special to offer to the world. You know, is about finding that special thing now. But every country can have specialized industries that nowhere, like you can't get it at that quality from anywhere else. And it's about, you know, looking inwards, building up those specialized industries, you know, ensuring that the core fundamentals things your citizens need to live is also localized to a certain degree, but leave the global markets open. So I think, hopefully, you know, I mean, we're still watching. We're still in very early days of this new phase. Hopefully that is what happens. The worst possible, outcome is everyone basically just retracts and global markets collapses, because it doesn't work for anybody. You know, we are already so used to globalization that it's going to be a disaster for everybody.
Well, what if, because again, student of history, what if our own specialization here in Africa, or specifically Nigeria, is Afrobeats? What if that's what, like, everybody else, well, yeah, China, you're doing this one, Taiwan, you're doing semiconductors. What if our own is Afrobeats,
Jai-Jai, it's culture?
What if it's vibes?
It's culture.
That is very sad. That's
Look at iSpeed. Wasn't that what he was doing? Did he go to any hard?
That is highly unfortunate.
He was just going to the vibe, the dancing, you know? The culture, yeah. The food, the music.
No, because these things are important. I do think I agree with you where, you know, it's a balance between global and also making sure you do have things that are sustainable. Because I do think if you do study history, to be fair, globalization led to less wars, right? I think the fact that the last world war was 1945, literally when it ended, we've literally had almost 100 years or almost 50 plus years of no wars at that level, right? And back then, they were much more retrenched. Everybody could produce things at home, people could, it wasn't as globalized as it is today. So yeah. One could argue, and I'm just talking about this from a philosophical standpoint, because I do think I'm trending to where your stance actually is. But as I was analyzing this, I was like, to be fair, it's not as if China has been going around bullying people or trying to say like we're about to start a war. Whereas before, a lot of those wars used to start because somebody would look at their situation and say, hey, we don't have enough oil here. Or like Japan, for example, part of what inspired them to go to war was the embargo, the sanctions, and then being like, okay, you know what? The Dutch West Indies, which was Indonesia at the time, has oil. We're going to have to hold out for you, right? So I think an argument could be made where maybe instead of retrenchment, actually much more enveloping more so that we are all connected and people are like, hey, don't bully us because you're doing this. And then, you know, let's see where it goes. But I do think like I'm somebody who does not like outsourcing critical things to other people, because once somebody offs your lights, it's only English you can speak.
Yeah.
You know?
To actually, you know, come in there a bit, I think the argument that globalization stopped wars is actually quite a mistake, because it stopped the wars between major powers.
Yeah.
There were still hundreds of proxy wars.
Yeah.
You know,
true.
If anything, it increased the wars within, you know, second tier and third tier powers, you know, like, because now these major powers have essentially nothing to lose, you know, and they're able to fund proxy wars across the globe. So, I don't think it has stopped wars in any way. But I do agree that this is what's like the world has to become now, you know, where we have to build our own sovereign capabilities in key industries while still leaving the global markets open.
Actually, before we transition, right, I think the other thing I would love our audience to learn, because yes, you are 22 years old. It's not rare that these are the conversations that a 22-year-old is having, right? So what are the, I know at 15, you had an experience where you went blind and whatnot. Can you speak to our audience as to how that experience shaped you? And there's a fire and there's a drive inside of you that anyone who's talking to you can feel, right?
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Can you break it down for our audience? But also, how has it shaped the man that we see sitting before us today?
Yeah. So at 15, I had an accident on my right eye. that put me in a coma for a while. I became blind. So basically, it happened on my 15th birthday. You know, you know, in some boarding schools, you're having fun, your friends are throwing water and stuff like that. And one of my close friends threw his slippers. I had a bucket on my face, shielded at a 60-degree angle. Somehow, the sandal broke the bucket, and a piece of the bucket went into my head, you know, shattering my eyes, and I blacked out. Several surgeries later, and the coma, I woke up, and you never truly appreciate life until you essentially experience, you know, a near-death experience. And there was this feeling of, like, when I woke up, I wasn't, like, scared or crying or whatever. It was this feeling of purpose. I felt like I had just been given a second chance in life. You know, for context, around this time when it happened, I was actually very depressed. I know I was 15. But I was very depressed because, you know, I've always been very ambitious, but I didn't know how to actually do it. You know, I was more of a talk, but never actually do anything. You know, but after this, I realized, like, first of all, you could die any moment. So make every day count. And, you know, second, if I had died then, I just died in nobody. You know, I just went as a statistic that, sure, my mom, my family would cry, but in a few years, I'm forgotten. You know, I'm just the dust in the ground. And that scared me. It caused like an existential crisis in me, and I wanted to then, it gave me this sense of purpose to do something with my life. Because I don't know when, you know, it's pretty funny, in a country where I think Nigeria's life expectancy is like 50 something.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks they'll get to 90. If you talk to everybody, everyone says, you know, when they're 90, it's, you know, I think that was like a very transformational experience for me, you know. And after that, I just never got scared of anything, you know, like, because like, it's, once you have experienced that, there's nothing that can scare you. Like, you're not scared of death. You're scared of dying in nobody. And I think that has been like, that has given me a level of audacity that, that I can't really, put in words.
Mm.
How does that make you relate to, because obviously we're also entrepreneurs on the couch and there's a level of ambition we also have. How has that shaped how you relate to family, friends, even coworkers, right? Because even I want to tie that back into what sort of person would thrive at Terra, right? Because I think sometimes when you, like, I think part of my own journey to start with a near-death experience too.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of, even Chika too dealt with grief that was also a death experience too, that like just unlocks something where you're like, look, we're not here to be statistics. We're not going to be spectators in the arena. We're going to actually jump in and see what we can do. How has that related with, how has that defined how you relate with people? And the reason why I'm asking this is sometimes you're so ambitious that slowing down or being present is not available. And I think for me at 22, bro, like, what, I'm 35 now, right? I've learned the trade-offs that you actually make in real time, where like, you're so ambitious, you want to do things, you want to do, and then you look back after 10 years and you were so ambitious that people, there's just a disconnect. And you, at the time when you're making those choices, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Then when you get to a certain age and you look back and you're like, maybe I could have, you know, balanced out here and there, right? So I want to ask you specifically, like, do you think about that? Like, as you're, because I can feel the fire, I can feel the passion. You remind me of Inye too, when I first met Inye at 24, 25. And it's the same thing. I'm now saying extrapolating 10 years from now, right?
Yeah.
How do you balance the relationships where there are things you're going to have to be present for? But then answer that question, then answer the sort of person that thrives currently at Terra as well.
Yeah. I mean, naturally, I am quite introverted. You know, I don't really like people. but I think it's... So building this company, essentially, you know, increased that even more. So beyond when I'm like working and all that, in my private life, I pretty much keep to myself most times. It's a sacrifice worth making. You know, there are certain times you have to make certain sacrifices. You know, it's not every time you get an opportunity to do something that could actually change everything. And I think for me, that is the way I see it, you know. So I know I'm missing out on a lot. You know, I've basically been working from the moment I lost the eye. So basically since I was 15, I've not had a lot of experiences in my life. But the experiences I do have, you can't trade it anywhere. It's something that I'm actually very proud of. You know, so yeah, it's just one of those things where I think what I'm doing is so important for the continent. It's so big for the continent that someone has to basically take one for the team, you know.
I agree. I think I will also circle back with you in 10 years to see, not that the ambition has died or any of that, yeah, but like what nuances have been introduced to it where I can maintain this ambition and what it is I want to achieve, but what yeah. else have you learned through the journey as well?
Yeah.
And I'm curious, at this stage of your life, what values are non-negotiable for you?
Values with me? Or
yeah, with values with you, yeah.
Oh,
And sorry, you can also tie that into the Terra question about what sort of values yeah. would you want somebody who's working at Terra to have? But yeah.
I think it's people that see life beyond, like that's, oh, okay, for me first. It's basically, you know, ambition, I think. I try to basically set, you know, where I want to be personally in my life and what I want to do in my lifetime, and what I want Terra to also become is so high that realistically, there's a very high chance I don't actually ever get there. Mm. But it is so high that it's basically you aim for the stars, you fall on the moon kind of situation, you know. So I set this because if you set your ambition very low, you get to achieve it very quickly. And once you achieve it, that moment when you ask like, what next, is the most dangerous moment. Because once you're asking what next, it's very easy for you to like get distracted and stuff like that. So I like to set very almost unrealistic, you know, goals for myself that, you know, I know within myself, very low chance of actually doing this, you know. And to be honest, most times I've actually done it, but, it just helps me keep focus. It helps me keep focus. I don't think in my lifetime I'll ever finish everything I want to do. And that is good because I must not ever relent throughout my life. I have to keep at it. The gas has to be full pedal, you know, till I'm able to at least come a bit close to what I think, I need to do while I'm here. And for like the people that are coming, that will be working at Terra, it's all about that. You know, like one question I always ask everybody when you want to work at Terra is like, what do you want to do with your life? You know, it's a trick question, essentially, you know, because I want to know your own ambition, independent of whatever job you're applying for. You know, if I'm hiring you for a job and I ask you what you want to do with your life, and you're telling me that this was your life's goal, I know you're lying. You didn't see this the ad to like last week. How's your life goal? You know, or you're telling me that you want to do this for 50 years. I'm like, bro, I may not even be doing this for 50 years. Like, what are you doing? You know, so it's like they need to have a larger goal for themselves. Then it's more realistic that okay, Terra is going to essentially be, you know, just a parting way for you towards your own goal. You know, it's just going to play a role in your own journey. So, I think that matters a lot. And people that really deeply care about the mission are going to pay you well. You know, you're going to get a lot of amenities. We are probably one of the best paying startups in Africa today. Ask our engineers, they are enjoying. But, you have to deeply be passionate about what we're solving. Because as I said earlier, you know, this is a struggle for the fate of the continent. If you don't care about this, you wouldn't put in that extra edge, you know, that you don't know how many people that would save. You know, you don't know what that extra edge, that idea that you presented, that feature that you added, either on the software or on the hardware, you don't know what that could save. You know, it could save a few hundreds of people. It could save thousands. It could save an entire country from an attack, you know. So what we're doing is very important work. And, you know, I think that is what matters to us.
Can you name one of the ambitious goals you have that you don't think you'll be able to achieve in this lifetime? Personally for you.
Yeah, personal. I want to single-handedly, if possible, you know, push Nigeria towards total industrialization. You know, the potential of this country is just too much. Every time I think of it, it's like I want to go mad. You know, I have never seen a country more blessed than Nigeria. You know, and for me now, it's about focusing on the pillars that the country would need to unlock its industrial potential. I don't know if I'll be able to do all of it. I don't even know if I'll be able to even do half of it. But I think it's worth trying. You know, I have time on my side. So I think for me, that is one big personal goal for me. You know, hopefully we're able to, you know, if even though I do a small part of it, some other people can do others, and, you know, collectively, we can then make it happen.
So Joe Lonsdale, he's co-founder of Palantir. He led the 11.5 million seed fundraise with his VC firm, 8VC.
Yeah.
What was the pitch that landed with him to enable him to bet big on Terra? What was his own geopolitical, or you don't even need to go there. What was the pitch that landed him?
I mean, Joe is one of the smartest guys in Silicon Valley, you know. He deeply understands where the world is heading. He did this with Palantir, you know, essentially saving the West when it was at the brink, you know.
Saving the West in what sense? So that our audience understands.
Saving the West when it was at the worst of terrorism, okay. You know, at the brink of collapse from terror. You know, Palantir was started after 9/11, and their entire goal was saving Western interests from terrorism, you know, protecting Western interests from terrorism. Is essentially similar playbook here. You know, terror right now is at its worst in the last 10 years. And he saw an opportunity, you know, to help Africa in a meaningful way, not by giving donations, not by giving bags of rice, by actually funding people that give a shit about saving the continent. You know, so for him, this was a no-brainer. You know, from the very first day that I spoke to him, he instantly got it. He knew why this needed to exist. He knew the opportunity here, sure, from a financial point of view, but he saw a much larger opportunity, and that is the opportunity to save an entire continent. You know, the industrial potential of Africa, if we can lay a modern security infrastructure, that is the real opportunity here. And that is something that excites every single one of our investors, you know. It was pretty straightforward on that.
And obviously, you guys manufacture in Africa. What went into that specific decision? Because like you said, you could have chosen to also outsource manufacturing to China for even different reasons. So what went into that decision?
Yeah. I mean, if we went the easy way of like outsourcing stuffs from, you know, China or wherever, first, you know, that is going against the entire idea of sovereign defense capability. We might as well just buy it and plaster our sticker there, you know. But second, sovereign intelligence, what it really means. Okay, let's look at Palantir again. Palantir basically builds the largest intelligence network in the West. they are almost everywhere in the West. They're helping track, detect and track terrorists on large scale, at a large scale. Now, Palantir did not need to manufacture anything because there was already existing surveillance infrastructure for data collection. They just had to build the software layer over. Now, when you come to Africa, the pre-existing surveillance infrastructure here is just essentially old analog CCTV cameras from China that their NVRs don't even allow you, super technical now, their NVRs don't even allow you to even integrate, you know, like to integrate any sort of software capability over. So essentially, we had to build, put the hardware infrastructure that is collecting data and then the software layer that is ingesting this data, fusing it from multiple sensing capabilities and analyzing and tracking the threats. You know, so we had to do two things at the same time. This is why we build the hardware infrastructure, because there was no pre-existing infrastructure to layer over. And also, for true data sovereignty, we had to ensure that every step of the way it belongs to us. You know, because if we're collecting the data with external hardware and the software is now being analyzed by us, that is already a breach. If we're collecting the data with our own hardware and the software is being analyzed by them, by the foreigners, that is also a breach. We have to control that end-to-end ecosystem to ensure we control not just the experience, but, you know, every point of data leak is essentially covered. Yeah.
What needs to happen for there to be 100 Nathans building in hardware, right? What do you think the environment needs to encourage to have more of our people coming into this space building in hardware?
I think just basically more local capital. I was fortunate, you know, to have access to Silicon Valley. Many people won't be. And their dreams would die here. You know, there needs to be more local capital, especially risk capital. We need to take big bets on things that don't initially make sense at first. But if it works, is a 1000x outcome.
Yeah.
You know, the way we make bets today, we take bets on essentially 10x or maybe 20x or 30x. You know, there's a higher likelihood it will work, but it working is not some revolutionary, you know, outcome. But the most transformational companies in the world today are those companies that there's a very big chance you are just wasting your money investing, but that slight chance it works will change everything. And those are the companies that change the world. You know, and we can't have those kind of companies here if we're not, you know, throwing capital at founders that could build those type of companies. You know, there is something that I always tell friends and, you know, like a few friends, you know. Terra basically has a binary outcome. It's either going to be the biggest company in Africa or the biggest failure in Africa. There's no two ways about it. And in a funny way, that actually excites me, because now, you know, we know that there's only two ways this can end. And why play small? Why go small? You go all out. We have nothing to lose here. You know, that's essentially the only way we can essentially build an ecosystem that is producing, you know, people that would be that would solve much more foundational deep tech problems.
And how did you get access to Silicon Valley? Like, what did that pathway look like for you?
I honestly have no idea. I just woke up one day and saw their number. But
really?
No, I'm joking. But I've been in this ecosystem for a while now. Even though I'm 22, I basically have 7 year experience here in this ecosystem.
Wait, and do you mean defense or
no, startup? Like he combined. Added in a startup.
Yeah, okay, combined. Okay.
Startup, yeah.
Okay.
You know,
because you're in education first.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
You know, combined. And, you know, people watch. People notice everything you do. You know, over time, I was able to build up good credibility around myself. And I also built relationships over time from class days that paid off big time when I finally started Terra. A lot of these relationships I started building out during class days, you know, they were with investors in Silicon Valley that typically backed like deep tech, you know, they backed SpaceX, they backed all these sort of companies. So they would not typically back, you know, like a SaaS edtech platform. But I still kept that relationship and was always just, you know, talking to them and all that. When I started Terra, and it really started like taking off and growing and picking up a lot of traction, they got interested very quickly. And we started nurturing that relationship. And eventually, you know, in Silicon Valley, everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how the ecosystem is here. You know, it's, we got intros to more people and more people. And, you know, as long as you're doing the right thing, word of mouth is essentially the way you get connected to these guys. And, the rest was history.
And you're not just necessarily focused in Nigeria. You're all across Africa as well, right? So I want to talk through, because a lot of the people in the audience might understand B2B, understand B2C, but you guys are B2G sometimes too, right? Which is like you're literally selling to governments as well. What does that process of closing governments look like? I think for those of us who've even ever have to dealt with any African governments, how slow sometimes that process can be like nerve-wracking. But you did say and mention like actually African governments do spend on two things, energy and security. So what does that look like in closing? Because I think I watched a video where you said for a lot of them, it's really show and tell. Like, don't come out and be telling us like what you plan to do. Is the drone taking off now? Is it being able to, can I see it in real time? So what does that look like to close these sort of government contacts?
Yeah. So it's been a very new experience. I'll say that. So yeah, at Terra, we mostly do B2G. We still do a bit of B2B to our commercial division, but now it's heavily, 90% of the company's resources is going towards B2G. You know, so the way defense contracting is done in Africa is fundamentally very different from how it's done in the West. In the West, it's very bureaucratic. It goes through several steps. So essentially, first, you submit, you know, your proposals or, you know, ideas of what you want to do. They give you a contract for, you know, a research contract that could take 1, 2, sometimes even up to 3 years. You build the initial prototype. It works. They could either give you a further research contract or you just go straight into a production contract. Typically, that entire cycle could take up to 5, sometimes 10 years. You know, it's super long, super bureaucratic. It's a bottom-up process. In Africa, it's a top-down process. It's heavily solution-first and network-based. So what I mean by solution-first is, just as you said, no one cares about papers here. You know, we don't have time to be reading technical proposal. Oh God, tell us what thing you feel do. You know, this is how they see it. So essentially, that model that Andrew have done is perfect for Africa, you know, where you essentially take on the R&D yourself, you build out fleets of this demo, like you build out demonstrators and you go and carry out actual demonstration, you know, with government agencies on the field. And this then, you know, translates into, you know, actual contracts. Now, the typical cycle for this just takes about 6 months compared to the multiple years that it takes in the West. It's much faster, much more straightforward. And by network based, it's very based on trust. When we first started, we were entirely just focused on commercial because we needed to basically build credibility. We couldn't just go and talk to government as, you know, 22-year-olds that basically, sure, we had the tech, but what, you know, but because when we went to talk to them, we already had a large portfolio of very impressive private assets under protection. You know, now they want to listen, you know, like, oh, you're protecting that power plant. Oh, you're protecting that, you know, refinery and so on. And that brought a lot more credibility and respect to the Terra team.
I want to talk about why aunties are so important to African history. Aunties represent curators of the African experience, and oftentimes they have been unacknowledged. They have literally held our archives before they were archives. They were literally institutions before we had institutions. They held so many important cultural artifacts, such as the way we braid our hair, the recipes of our cookings. They represent abundance. There's literally a reason why we call an African culture rich aunties. And we believe that with partnering with Anthony, we're able to showcase this type of history through art. So to connect to African history and get a piece of the Anthony and Afropolitan collection called Auntie, make sure to click the link in the description. And this is your way you can support our channel.
So babes, I'm always talking to you about investing. How's your journey going so far?
It started because you've been on my head for the past 6 months about investing, and you'll be proud of me because I actually found an app I love. It's called RiseVest. And actually what I love about it is that you can start with $10 and it automates everything for you. So literally I just go to the app and literally it's investing for me every single day.
Yeah, because we know you're not going to be a trader anytime soon. But with RiseVest, you're going to be able to invest in US stocks, right? Fixed income, real estate, etc. Right. And so I'm happy you're finally on board.
And you know, the funny thing too is I always tell my girls that as women, we're not investing enough, we're not talking about it, and we're not having these conversations. So I shared it in all my group chats. So you can find RiseVest on the Apple and Google Play Store.
Okay. Make sure to use code Afropolitan so that they know that we sent you. You know how every week we sit down with people who've done it, people who've built, people who've led movements, people who've created culture. What if you could do more than just listen to them? That is why we built Convo by Afropolitan. On Convo, you're able to book one-on-one video calls with in-demand experts from Africa and the diaspora. Go to convo.vip to get access to your next mentor, because sometimes one convo can change your entire path. So we're going to transition to our rapid fire segment, which is where we hit you the first question and the first thought that comes into your mind. That's what we need from you. Is Pan-Africanism realistic or romantic idealism?
It's realistic.
Nigerian tech ecosystem, overhyped or underhyped?
Underhyped for now.
Lisa, for now.
What's more important for Africa right now, software innovation or hardware manufacturing?
Hardware.
What's your favorite Nigerian food?
I don't eat Nigerian food.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, why?
So what's your favorite food?
I don't have a favorite food. I just eat egg.
Really? So is it like you just eat to sustain? Like, you
basically
know?
I just eat not to die.
That's so, when did that start?
Like 10 years ago, for some reason I just stopped eating a lot of food. So I don't eat a lot. Like in terms of variety, I just eat three things over and over again.
So egg,
spaghetti, and meat.
And meat. Chicken, beef.
So no soups? No ofe, owere, no nothing?
Yeah.
Damn, brother. Okay, what's the one superpower you wish you had?
One single one?
Superpower that you wish you had.
To stop time. Yeah.
Why? Why is that?
You always need more time.
Favorite African founder, except yourself, of course.
That's a hard one.
Who do you look up to, basically?
In the ecosystem?
Yeah.
I guess GB.
Okay. Will Africa industrialize in your lifetime?
Oh, yeah.
Most definitely.
He has time. He's 22.
Yeah, yeah, no, you know,
maybe not in ours, but...
It has to, right?
Do you code anymore, or has that ship sailed for now?
Yeah, for now it's ship sailed. I mostly now in like pure physics.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So I know the question we ask our guests, every guest that comes before.
Wait,
we end
I gotta
up.
Ask that question.
Okay, no, go on ahead.
you can't be the one to switch things up.
Let's switch it up last minute.
Yeah, you try to switch things up. Okay, so the last question we ask every single guest on the Afropolitan podcast is, who do you want to see in that chair, and whose story do you think needs to be told?
Like, do they have to be someone popular?
No. In fact, anyway. That's the best ones are not popular.
My co-founder.
Yeah.
He has a very interesting personal story too.
Interesting.
Yeah. Also, could you speak on how you guys even met? We didn't even touch on that. Like, because co-founder relationships are so important in building any startup, right? So what does that look like, in the symbiotic relationship you guys had, especially going into something this hard? Like,
Yeah. Well, we met where all great men meet, Twitter. we met on Twitter 3 years ago.
Three.
Yeah, 3 years ago. He reached out. Back then, he was doing something else. I was doing something else. And, you know, we had shared interest in robotics, physics, you know, and we are just basically bouncing ideas off each other. Every now and then, we just have a call and just talk about a lot of random things. There wasn't really any, like we didn't plan to actually start a company till 2024. You know, it was sometime in, he eventually sold his first company. And sometime in 2023, late 2023, we now started to seriously talk about like where the world is headed. You know, it was now more philosophical and geopolitical. That was actually what led to this company. It wasn't like we're like, okay, there's like we have a product now we need to sell, or there's money in the market. It was purely from a philosophy and geopolitics standpoint. You know, we saw where the world was heading post Russian Ukraine invasion, and it was just it was clear that the time for an African defense prime is now, and we just said, you know what, let's just start it. You know, what could possibly go wrong?
What was it about the Russia-Ukraine action that made you guys think this is where the world is going? What specifically did you see around that?
I mean, that changed everything. You know, the entire geopolitical winds of the world changed after that. I want to choose my words very carefully here. But yeah, it was just clear. For example, you know, when that invasion happened, first of all, you know, there was like grain scarcity. You know, Nigeria, a country that should be supplying the world with grain, you know, was having grain scarcity. You know, it just didn't make sense.
Because we import from Ukraine. Right?
Yeah, because we import from Ukraine. You know, like, I think that war showed the fragility of globalization.
Yeah.
And it was simply after that war that people were like, okay, I think we should start building, you know, sovereign industries, you know, sovereign supply lines, sovereign defense, especially because whatever world order has kept global peace is all falling apart, you know, and it's clear that the only people that can protect you is you. So, yeah, I think that was a huge booster for our ideology.
Mm. Okay, so I definitely want to definitely piece that a little bit more, but that's on a philosophy standpoint, because I can definitely have that conversation with you offline, but I'll have a little bit of it with you here. Is that not also somewhat of an illusion in the sense of when you look at prior to globalization, there were countries that had invested in defense, right? But if you think about it from like a Greek perspective, like the strong do what they can, the weak endure what they must, right? Like Canada, 41 million people. This is straight math, right? 41 million people. America, 300 million people. Russia, 150 million people. Ukraine, maybe like 30 million people. China, 1 billion people. Taiwan, maybe 200 million people. Bro, like, I don't know what defense you want to be defending, but like at some point, like you're going to run out of human bodies, which is literally part of the equation. Or maybe all of us just get nuclear and then we hold nuclear on the side and then we're like, okay, how you want to do it, so we're all good to go.
That math would have made a lot of sense probably 100 years ago, but autonomy has become a leveling playing field. You know, now with drones and other unmanned systems, those are force multipliers. You know, essentially the only thing stopping you from, you know, not producing enough to defeat your enemy is your own industrial base.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, it's not how many humans you can throw to the field anymore. So you could even see countries with 5 million, 7 million population, you know, holding back countries with 100 million, all because they have built sustainable you know, military industrial complexes. So the days of, because if you're going back from the mouth of like World War One, World War Two, essentially it was one machine to one human.
Yeah.
You know, every machine was manned. So at some point, yes, you will run out of men. That was basically what Germany ran into. Yeah. You can't fight the whole world and expect, you know, to win, if except you have like 500 million people. But if you're now looking at, you know, the way warfare is fought today, you can essentially have one too many. You know, one operator can control hundreds of unmanned systems, possibly thousands. You know, that changes the entire equation.
That's a really good point. Because if you take, for example, Taiwan with the semiconductors, and they've already had, what, like almost 20 plus years of compounding in that specialized field.
Yeah.
You can imagine them like building enough drones to cover the entire continent. And then what do you then do with that at that point?
Exactly.
And if anything, it gives you leverage where somebody has to think twice before even coming to you in the first place.
Exactly.
I love that. I love that. Thank you for giving us that perspective too. Nathan,
thank you.
Well, thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.